2 days passed in the same easy fashion as the previous ones, with time spent reading and talking, sparring and swimming, in snow fights and in walks around the hills of Crescent Heights. With the able assistance of Miki and the willing, if somewhat patchy, help of Corwin, Kate and Utina finished their classwork and transmitted it back to Earth on the afternoon of the 31st, and thus finally had done with their slightly extended B-term. New Year's Eve in New Avalon was a big deal. The city, always glittering, was even more alight than usual on that one night out of the year, as the buildings downtown left their lights on, wasting energy for the sake of pageantry. The New Avalon Symphony Orchestra left Symphony Hall and gathered on the Grand Common in Avalon Center Park, trusting in the climate control field of the Common Bowl to keep their instruments from freezing, and played a free concert for the tens of thousands of revelers who braved the cold every year to flock into the park. Parties by the thousands dotted the city, from humble apartment affairs to the grand galas of the major corporations. The Avalon Center Galleria stayed open all night. So did many of the city's restaurants. The city hadn't seen all that many New Years yet, but it had learned how to have fun to commemorate them. Griffin decided to stay home this year, read a book, and watch the festivities on TV in the den. This was, perhaps, more proof that he had become elderly, but he took it in stride. No madding crowd for him this year, after all that had gone on in the last week or so. Kay was content to curl up on the couch with him and forgo the usual carousing for once as well, if only for the change of pace. Sylvie collected the twins at around 6 and vanished with them for points unknown and unasked. Megazone was taking them on a field trip, and that in itself was enough for Griffin and Kay. The Shannon twins appeared at around the same time and joined Leonard in the basement, where Achka and Len intended to spend the evening listening to music and taking Tenchi's money at 8-ball. This left Kate, Utina, Miki, Corwin, and Nall at a bit of a loose end, so Kate asked her parents if they could go downtown for the free concert and to see the Beacon and such like. Griffin met this request, as she had known he would, with a thoughtful frown. "Are you sure, hon?" he asked. "That's an awful big crowd." Said Kay. "I don't have a problem with a lot of them going, as long as they make sure they stick together." She added to Kate, by way of explanation, "In a group you can take care of each other, and if there is anybody nasty out there, they'll be less willing to try you if it's obvious you're all together." Griffin considered this and nodded. You're right." He turned back to Caitlin. "As long as you'll be okay." "Ah, Dad," she said, and leaned forward to kiss him on the cheek. "You worry too much. Like Mom said, as long as we stick together, I'll be fine. Nothing can happen to me with my guardian angels on standby," she said with a grin. He pulled her into an embrace. "I have to worry," he said. "It's my job." If I had worried a little more, he thought, but didn't say it. Instead, he fought down an urge to surround her with razor wire and stand guard with sword drawn, and let her go, watching with hand raised as she trotted merrily out to the living room to tell the others that they were go for launch. When he sat down again on the couch, he saw Kay giving him a peculiar look, somewhere between a private smile and a look of compassion. "Tough, isn't it?" she said. He heaved a sigh. "Sometimes I wonder if I'm ever going to get this parent thing right." "Oh, I think we're doing okay," she replied, and snuggled up to her husband, putting an arm behind his back. "She has good friends. That reflects on us, you know." Griffin gave her a look. "How do you figure?" "Well," said Kay, "we must have done something right if she can get total strangers to love her as much as we do." Griffin laughed. "Maybe you've got something there after all," he conceded. So. A pause. "So, you want to fool around?" "Len's still here." "Bah! You always were the timid type." "So," said Utina as Kate emerged from the hall into the living room. Kate grinned and showed a thumbs up. "All right," said Corwin. They bundled up, for it was a cold night to herald a new year, cold enough to force Utina into her winter-weight uniform, overcoat and all. Corwin added a retro touch to his winter ensemble by topping his own woolen overcoat with a long black cloak, finally putting that cloak clasp to its intended use, and a snappy fedora hat. Utina expressed dismay over the hat, protesting that it covered up his hair, so he plunked it down on her head, where it garnered so much applause that it stayed by popular demand. Swathed in scarves, gloves, and ear warmers, they plunged out into the chill, a merry band, three teenage duelists and a demigod with a dragon on his shoulder. At the corner of Morgan and Rush, Corwin stopped in mid-sentence as if he'd just had an idea, then said, "You guys hang on a second, I'll be right back." Then he plunked Nall on Utina's shoulder and shoved his way into the telephone booth standing on the corner. "What the..." Utina started to ask, but then Corwin dialed a number, replaced the phone on its receiver, and vanished. "Oh," said Utina. A minute or so later, Corwin reappeared, but now he was not alone. Fortunately, it was a large phone booth. "Dorothy," said Utina, pleased, as both recent arrivals from the underground emerged. "Hey, nice of you to join us," Nall agreed, sarcasm for once absent from his tone. "I'm trying to be a more social creature," said Dorothy, in a tone of voice that didn't imply it, but she was here all the same, in red dress and black overcoat, with a neat, round, broad-brimmed hat cocked at a pleasant angle on her auburn head. She regarded Utina levelly for a second, then added, "The hat suits you." Utina touched the fedora's brim a little self-consciously and said with a smile, "Thanks." There was indeed a great crowd on the common to hear the symphony orchestra and watch the fireworks that night, but it was a docile one and jovial. As the six of them walked the streets of the city toward their destination, why ride the train on such a brisk and vigorous night? Strangers greeted them with smiles. Cops gave them friendly salutes. A lot of them knew Kate by sight, given her association with Martin Rose. Elders favored them with indulgent smiles, perhaps remembering similar outings in their own youths with their own friends. To Utina, it was something like the way she'd spent the last Friday night, but different at the same time. There were more of them, and more of everyone else. The streets didn't have that sense of vacancy, of snug anticipation, that they'd had on Christmas Eve. That had been a private, quiet kind of night. This was different. This was a community celebration, and everyone was involved to join in the spirit. The symphony orchestra was magnificent, as always. Caitlin explained to Miki and Utina that a lot of serious music critics sneered at them for the programs they played on two occasions out of the year, this and Foundation Day, July 4th. It was popular music, considered too common and not challenging enough for a serious orchestra by your truly stuck-up critical types. She further explained that their conductor, a maverick earthman by the name of Jerry Walker, didn't particularly care, and so the tradition survived. It was clear that Walker was something of a hero to her, which didn't surprise Miki much. He'd already had ample time to realize that there was a broad streak of the musical maverick in Kate, too, and he liked that about her. At any rate, there was music, possibly common, but also stirring, pleasing, and well-performed. There were fireworks. There were hot sausages and cocoa sold from little carts that dotted the park. Another city tradition, according to Corwin, who was quite fond of the sausages, if not as fond as Nall. There was a chance encounter with one of Corwin's schoolmates, a very pleasant, polite seventh-grade girl who was called Fu, and whose last name he could not remember to save his life. There was Dorothy, out of the lab and into a crowd, and actually, by God, enjoying herself. She didn't much look it, but Corwin could tell, and his grin told Kate and Utina. At 10 seconds to midnight, the orchestra led the assembled in a countdown, accompanied by flashes on the seconds from the beacon at the pinnacle of the entire state building. When midnight struck and 2405 arrived in New Avalon, that beacon flared with a brilliant and different light, beams of white radiance streaking out into the four cardinal directions from its faces to illuminate the four corners of the pseudo-continent for a moment and let everyone living there know that the new year had come. The orchestra gave the beacon a few respectful seconds to fade back to its normal white glow, then swung into Sing, 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 which they played every year because neither Jerry Walker nor Griffin liked Auld Lang Syne. The Lindy Hop was an odd way to ring in the new year, but Utina had to concede that it was certainly more fun than getting maudlin and trying to pronounce Gaelic. They got home at 1:30 to find the house dark and silent, but after the concert and the bracing walk home, they were all too wired to sleep. They went down to the basement, where they wouldn't disturb the sleepers upstairs, and sat around for a bit, talking, having a last mug of cocoa, and unwinding. "So," said Corwin, "anybody have a New Year's resolution?" "I'm trying to be a more social creature," said Dorothy, in exactly the same way she'd said it before. But there was a tiny, tiny hint of a smile on her face when she said it, and it made Corwin burst out laughing, then raise his mug. "I'll drink to that," he said, and five mugs clanked gently together. "I want to get back to Toronto at least twice this year," said Kate, "and spend longer there." "Amen," said Utina. "I want to catch the biggest fish anybody's ever pulled out of the river Alpenstein," Noll declared. When that got him a funny look from all assembled, he drew himself up a bit huffily and said, "They don't have to be lofty goals, just goals." "I suppose," said Kate. "I think I'll learn a new instrument," mused Mickey. "Broaden my musical horizons the way I've had my personal ones broadened for me," he added with a wry grin for Utina. "Ever considered the guitar?" Kate asked him. "No, but maybe I should," he replied with a mild smile. "How about you, Corwin?" Utina asked. The hour, the occasion, and the warm sense of pleasant tiredness that was settling over him made Corwin just a little bit reckless. He grinned at her and replied, "I'd like to spend more time hanging out with my sister and that beautiful roommate of hers." Utina reddened, but kept smiling, and replied, "I think maybe that can be arranged." "Also," Corwin went on as his own words hit him and brightened his own cheeks as well, "I think it'd be good to start getting enough sleep so my impulse control improves. So how about you?" Utina considered this question for several seconds, swirling the last of her cocoa around in the bottom of the mug in an effort to redissolve the dregs. "It's not a resolution, really, so much as a realization, but I've decided tonight that I don't want my old life back." Mickey gave a little gasp and stared at her. So, too, did Kate. Corwin didn't really get the byplay, since he didn't know the story other than that Utina was displaced from somewhere or other and had left behind friends she wasn't sure she'd see again. "What?" she asked. "Think about it, Mickey. It wasn't much to go back to. No, what I want is to have the few good things from back home, here, in this life. That's my goal, to find a way to have that. I don't know exactly how or how long it'll take, but I'll make it work." She grinned at Mickey. "I've got one of them already." Relieved, Mickey seemed to slump a little bit, the lingering effects of the shock making his smile a trifle wan. "Thank goodness," he said. "For a second there, I thought you'd lost your mind." "I've wondered that myself from time to time over the past few months," Utina replied. "But no, that's what I want for my future. And in the meantime, I'm going to live this life I have now," she added. "Forward! Onward! Upward! Are you with me, Mickey?" "Certainly I am." "Kate?" "Of course." "Noll?" "I have no idea what you're talking about, but count me in anyway," said Noll. "I'm always up for a foolhardy quest, and what you just said has all the hallmarks." "Heh, thanks. Dorothy?" Dorothy gave her a thoughtful look and said dryly, "I must agree with Noll in all particulars." "Corwin?" "Anything I can do," he said immediately. "Speak my name," he added grandiloquently. "It shall be done." "Shazam!" said Noll. Corwin gave him a brief glare. "Cut me some slack, Furball. I'm tired," he said. Then he got to his feet, bowed, and said, "And now I'm going to bed before I say or do anything really stupid. Good night, everyone." Nall hopped to his shoulder and said his own good nights, and they retired. Miki followed shortly, and Dorothy not long after that. Kate and Newton had stayed up longer, talking over their plans for the next school term, until it occurred to them that it would be pretty silly to fall asleep in the basement. They, too, retired, and the first day of 2405 dawned without witnesses at 105 Morgan Lane. The rest of the break, without schoolwork to occupy anyone's time any longer, passed with a sublime combination of frivolous diversions, idyllic laziness, athletic endeavor, and literary pursuits. After a day, Utrina did indeed understand why Corwin thought she'd already read Zelazny's Chronicles of Amber. He was apparently named for their main character, and, aware of this, had consciously drawn some of his personal style from his namesake, mainly in terms of colors. That Utrina had, out of the blue, given him the very device which his literary namesake used as his personal symbol was clearly grounds for suspecting her of foreknowledge, if not prescience. On Utrina's first night in New Avalon, Corwin had gone out of his way to show her the city, driving a loop around Highway 29, the Ring Road, to show it off from all angles. Just before they went their separate ways at bedtime that night, she'd said she wanted to see more of the place before she left. On Tuesday, he made good on his promise to arrange that. They left the house after breakfast, he cloaked, she still wearing his hat, and made a day of it. They drove, rode trains, and tramped up one side of New Avalon and down the other. They hit the Museum of Science first, then lunch at Allard's, the Hotel Monolith's house restaurant. After that, various and sundry points of interest all over the map. Nightfall found them walking along the shore of Daniel's Lake, talking about nothing in particular. They'd talked about nothing in particular all day, in fact, and had a pretty good time doing it. "So what's there to see around here in the dark?" she wondered. "Should we head back?" "Not quite yet," he replied. "There's one thing you haven't seen yet, and I'd never forgive myself if I didn't show it to you. We should wait until after rush hour, though." He looked at his watch. "We could kill a couple hours at the WDF Museum. Lots of cool stuff there, if you're into antique Mecca." Utrina wasn't, particularly, but background information on this world and its history was always good, so they went. By the time they were done with the exhibits and the short movie, it was time for dinner. They were mulling over what to do about that when Utrina spotted the sign for the Marché Mövenpick at the Empire State Building. Corwin, it turned out, had never been there, and Utrina, having greatly enjoyed the one in Toronto, promptly dragged him into it, turnabout being fair play and all that. "This is cool," he observed as they sat down with their bounty at a corner table in the inner courtyard so they could watch the elevators go up and down in their cluster tubes. "All the times I've been in and out of this building and this place just never registered." "It's great," agreed Utrina. "The one in Toronto's not in a building as big as this, though. Does this atrium thing go all the way up?" "Nah, only to the 80th floor," said Corwin. "The sky wouldn't be visible anyway, what with the size of the building's base." "Yeah, I guess not. Still, be a hell of a thing to fall off one of those upper stories." "Every now and then, some punk kid comes in here and does it on purpose with a parachute or thruster wing. Instant jail time, just add water." He grinned slyly. "If you're gonna do that, you ought to at least bring a phase cloak, too." He gestured vaguely with a French fry. "It's just as well we're here, though. This is where we were going to come next, anyway." "Oh? Check out the view from the observation deck?" "Something like that," replied Corwin with a mysterious grin, but he refused to elaborate. After dinner, they rode up one of the express elevators to the 250th floor, 26 stories shy of the top. This was not, as Utrina expected, an observation deck. Instead, it was a deserted-looking office floor. The elevator opened onto a featureless corridor studded with security keypad doors, dimly lit by overhead fluorescence. Not very promising. "Is this the right floor?" she asked. "Yep." Corwin led the way down the corridor, unconcerned. Shrugging, she followed him down the hall, around a bend to the left, and down another hallway, ending at a double door marked 250/11A, private, no entry. Corwin smiled and tapped out a code on the keypad, and the door unlocked with a click. He swung it open, paused for a moment, then decided it would be ruder to let her precede him into a dark room than to walk in ahead of her, went in and switched on the lights. Then he went back to the door and held it open, bowing her inside. The room beyond was large, about the size of a school gymnasium, and similarly decorated, that is to say, not at all. Its only real feature, aside from a large rolling steel door that took up most of the far wall, was a small airship, black with silver go-faster stripes, parked like a car in the middle of the room. The airship was built along the classical lines. Its gas bag was about the size of a bus, with a gondola that looked like a two-seat air car, retractable landing gear, twin fans, and all. "You've got your own blimp?" Utna blurted. "Zeppelin, actually," replied Corwin offhandedly. "Rigid is better." There was a rather awkward pause, in which Corwin's face slowly went bright scarlet. Said Corwin. Utna grinned, scruffled up his hair, and said, "Shall we?" Yeah, said Corwin. He recovered his aplomb bit by bit as they crossed to the airship. He unlocked it and held the passenger's door for her. He'd been holding doors for her all day, in fact, and she hadn't gotten tired of it yet. She was more accustomed to being the one doing the chivalry, but the way Corwin did it, she didn't mind the re-reversal for some reason. Maybe it was the fact that he was the very antithesis of a man with a hidden agenda. After all she'd been through back home, she felt she ought to be suspicious, but she just couldn't manage it, not with him. Strangely, as all that ran through her mind in the 10 seconds it took her to sit down and strap in, none of it made her uneasy, even though she consciously acknowledged that it probably should have. For some reason, she was rather glad for that. Then she abandoned the train of thought entirely, in favor of taking in her new situation. The interior of the gondola was as much like an air car as the outside, a two-place cockpit with comfortable seats, a low instrument panel with a control yoke on the left-hand side, and a wide, panoramic windshield. The ceiling was high enough that she could sit up straight without endangering her hat. Corwin climbed in, strapped himself down, and ran briskly through a brief pre-flight checklist before powering the craft up and releasing the magnetic clamps that held it to the floor. It lightened slightly as the flight computer automatically adjusted the trim. Corwin smiled. "My favorite trick," he said, and thumbed the landing gear retract switch. There was a whir, a clunk, and otherwise nothing seemed to happen. "Perfect trim," he announced. "Neutral buoyancy. We're flying right now." "Neat." Corwin's grin got a little wider. He pressed a key that opened the rolling door, then throttled up the fans, and the little Zeppelin glided out of its hangar and into the night sky. "How are you with heights?" he asked, a bit belatedly. Utna looked over at him, then burst out laughing. When she'd recovered somewhat, she waved off his perplexed look, gasping, "Long story. I'm fine with heights." "Okay, cool," he said, and tabbed a couple of controls. The floor panels shimmered, then went transparent, adding to the excellent view already afforded by the broad windshield. "Ah," said Utna, but it wasn't a distressed "ah." In fact, if Corwin were asked to judge by her face, he would guess it was an "ah" of delight. She looked about like she'd looked when testing the Thorn of the Rose against an imaginary opponent in the dojo. He felt a little glowy, feeling it, having been able to make her look that way again. He guided the Zeppelin up above the city's controlled traffic area, into the free flight zone, and made a slow orbit, swinging out over the dark expanse of Daniel's Lake. "I know there's not much to see this way," he said, "but give me a minute, and I'll show you the best view in town." Utna waited patiently, smiling, as Corwin piloted his airship out over the lake, then paused for a second before kicking in some hard rudder, laying the helm over, and sweeping around in a great turn to starboard. As he did so, New Avalon, with all its spires and towers, its golden night gleam, its twinkling aircraft beacons, and the flickering and flashing marker lights of its air traffic, flowed smoothly into view through the windshield like the unrolling of a beautiful tapestry. Utrina made another delighted noise, this one more drawn out, and leaned forward to take it all in. For the next hour, Corwin guided the airship deftly over, around, and through the city, plying the beacon-marked skylanes amid the buildings with deft, steady hands on the helm and a contented smile on his face, keeping quiet and letting his passengers soak up the city from every angle. It was Utrina, then, who broke the silence as they crossed over the snow-filled bowl of Knight's Field, shut down for the winter. "So," she said. "Hm?" he asked. "Kate's doing a lot better, don't you think?" "Oh, definitely," Corwin agreed. "Working with your pal from the old country's really been good for her. He came along at just the right time." He grinned. "Nice guy." "Yeah, they're a lot alike. Both good friends to have," Utrina said. "Meeting Kate was the best thing that could have happened to me after I had to leave home." Corwin turned south to overfly Chandler's Point and said, a little timidly, "I'm glad she met you, too." She smiled at the trepidation in his voice and the color in his cheeks, reminded again how much younger he was than she and Kate. Sometimes it was hard to keep in mind, given all that he was, all that he could do, but then it showed so clearly at moments like this. Utrina ruffled his hair again and said fondly, "I think I'll miss you most of all, Scarecrow." Corwin smiled. "Maybe you won't have to," he said, emboldened. "After all, I'll be coming by to check on Dorothy as often as I can manage. Maybe, if you want, we could, you know, hang out." She grinned. "I'd like that." "You would? Great." "What's that over there?" asked Utrina, pointing. "Where?" "Oh, that. That's the new WDF Academy."
"New?"
"Yeah, the original one was on Planitia, Zeta Cygni II, back before the sphere was built. It closed in 2288 when the WDF fell. When it reopened, they used the new campus. See how the quad is shaped like the WDF seal?"
"Oh yeah, neat. What happened to the old one?"
"It's still there. Not used for anything, as far as I know. Planitia's kind of derelict now. The old shipyard ring complex and everything. Dad mentioned once he'd like to dust it all off and make a museum out of it, but he's never had the time."
"Derelict? A whole planet?"
"Well, no. I mean, people still live in Planitia City and Tektropolis and all. But most of the old WDF facilities were never reopened after the exile, because of the sphere and all the new construction here on the Avalon pseudocontinent."
"How did they ever build this sphere in the first place?"
"Dunno exactly. It's one of the great mysteries of the Reconstruction. Dad and old Wolfgang won't say where it came from, and everybody else from back then says it was here when they got here. It's the only one of its kind in known space."
"Wow."
Utrina sat back in her seat and thought it over. "He built all this, brought all these people together, to fight for the freedom of a whole galaxy. And he still pretty much lives like an ordinary guy."
Corwin grinned.
"That's Dad. He works hard not to forget where he came from."
"I guess that's where you get it from, huh? If you can call taking your sister's roommate on a Zeppelin ride ordinary," she added with a bit of a smirk.
"Well, it's not that weird in New Avalon. We're the airship capital of known space," he said with pride. "Now, you want unordinary, I'll take you to Mom's hometown sometime. The Golden City doesn't have New Avalon's technical edge, but it's sure something to see. Especially when the dragons are in town. Oh, hey, we saw that earlier, but you were having so much fun just looking that I didn't want to break things up by talking about it. That's Monument Park. See that torch-type thing? That's the only monument in the galaxy to a Usenet newsgroup." The little Zeppelin cruised off toward the west, as Corwin repeated parts of his fly-around with narration this time, and they whiled away the evening, lighter than air. It was the custom of the Worcester Preparatory Institute to reopen the dorms on the Friday before classes resumed on a Monday, to give the students a weekend to settle back into their rooms and routines without having to do any work.
Students were not required to come back until Sunday night, or even Monday morning if they felt like pushing it. But Friday was a good day to get things like course additions and subtractions done before classes started, and the no-work weekdays were good for socializing and filling one's school friends in on what one did over the holidays, so most tended to reappear on Friday. Caitlin was no exception, and this time there was extra incentive to get back early. Not one, but two new students, who could use the extra spare time to get the lay of the land around the Institute and get acquainted with some of their new schoolmates before the pressures of coursework kicked in. The paperwork was filed, the identity documents provided. It was awfully convenient, Miki Kaworu reflected, to know a head of state. The Republic of Zeta Cygni was, in large part, embodied by Caitlin's father. The supplies prepared. Corwin fretted and compiled a massive maintenance and repair document for Dorothy, which he presented to Miki in exchange for grave assurances that he would read it thoroughly, follow its procedures carefully, and call Corwin instantly if the slightest sign of trouble arose. Legal responsibility for Dorothy's presence at the Institute fell to Caitlin. As Corwin's sister, she had the clearest line of accountability back to him. The admissions department fussed a bit, but agreed to take Dorothy as a provisional student, with the understanding that she was to be Turing certified over the summer break if she intended to return for term AO5. And so it was that, bright and early on the morning of Friday the 7th, they packed their things into Corwin's car, said their goodbyes to those remaining behind, and headed for Matthews Memorial Spaceport, Dagger Disk, and the stars beyond the sphere. Leaving home or heading home? The endless quandary of the boarding school student. "Did I thank you lately for inviting me to come back with you?" Utena asked Kate across the wardroom's game board, while the rest were up in the cockpit, Miki busy being impressed by metaspace.
"Depends on your definition of lately," Kate replied dryly, moving a pawn.
"Well, thanks, all the same. I had a terrific time. Your family's great."
"We try," said Kate mildly.
Thanks for coming, she countered. Then she looked up from the board, met her roommate's eyes, and added seriously,
I don't know what I'd have done if you hadn't.
Well, we're even then, said Utena. I don't know what would have become of me if I'd ended up with anyone but you when I came to this world.
Kate smiled and held out her hand, with exaggerated solemnity. Utena took it.
Look out, 2405, said Kate.
Here we come, Utena concurred. Airy Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features, Symphony of the Sword, Third Movement, A Rose for the New Year. The symphony will return with Duelists of the Rose.